And we're holding on Nundalid Omidvey, the second line from the bottom. We learned in the Mishnah about that the various dinim, where we say that even though the Torah mentions that it applies to a shur or a chamur or the two of them together, we learn that that it applies to all of them. And we learn we had different ways that we had different ways. One particular one we said a few of them we learn from details that it says by Shabbos, where in the food we talk about the comparison and contrast between their wording in the first Dibras and in the second, where in the first one, in Parshas Yisroi, it just says that after that Abdechov, Amoshov, and Techa, your animals can't do Malacha, and in the second one it spells out which animals are Shorcha, Vachamorcha, Bechol, Behem, Techa, and we said that from that we use those extra words as parts of Zera Shavas to learn that the same thing applies to other genes. So now the Gemara is going to talk about a similar kind of contrast between the wording of the first and second Dibras as far as between the first and second Dibras in Yisrael versus in Vayis Chanan as far as a different one of the Dibras. So the Gemara says, Shor Rab Chanina ben Ogilos es Rab Chia ba'aba. Mekne ma b'dibras harishonis lo nema b'hem toiv or b'dibras harishonis nema b'hem toiv. Why is it in the first Dibras, in Parashas Yisroi, does it not say the word Toiv? In fact, there's not even a letter Tes anywhere in the first Dibras. Whereas by the second one, it does. When it comes to the mitzvah of Kibbut Av Ve'im, the first one just says, Kavadis Avicha V'asimecha, L'man Yarichon Yamecha. The second one, it says, L'man Yarichon Yamecha, U'l'ma'an Yitav Loch, in order that your days should be long, that you have in both of them, and in order that it should be good for you, that you have something added in the second Dibras, that in Vayis Chanan that you don't have in Parshas Yisroi. So why is that? Amalai said, "Rabbi Abba answers, Ad sha'ata shaleni loma nema behen tov. Before you start asking me whether it says in them tov, shaleni im nema behen tov. First, better you should ask me the question: does it say tov in there im lab or not? She'eni yadeya im nema behen tov im lab. I don't know whether it says tov in them or not." Now, you have the obvious question, what does Rav Chiya Ba'aba mean by that? Does he actually not know the words of the Pesukim and know that it says Laman Yitav Lochem, the second one? It sounds like he's saying, never mind why it is that way, first let's establish whether it is that way. When whether it is that way, he doesn't know the Pesukim. So in fact, during our Shas, Rabbi Akiva Eger over here refers to a Tosfos in Baba Basra that says in a different context that yes, there were some Amoraim who were not really so familiar with the Pesukim. So that could be one answer. Then the Pashat Rav Chiya Ba'aba was not familiar enough with the Pesukim to be able to know. With that said, though, many Meforshim and many different Sfarim deal with this, and a huge amount of ink has been spilled about it because it doesn't really seem a very satisfactory answer. First of all, it's hard to say that. First of all, that Tosfos says it over there in Baba Basra is odd enough. But here we're talking about Rav Chiya Ba'aba, one of the greatest in Amoraim, and we find in other places where he himself was an expert in Agadah and Droshes of Pesukim. And besides that, we're talking about the Aseres HaDibros, which people know the wording of the Aseres HaDibros. So they have a lot of different points about it. First of all, Maushah's Gusa over here is a little bit different, but he has Rav Chiya Ba'aba saying is it in fact the case that in the second Dibras it says Toiv, but rather the other way around, that he's saying, is it in fact the case that there's no word Toiv, and in fact no letter Tes in the entire first Dibras? So conceivably that might be the kind of thing that he's not really a person would have to think into that, and it's not so obvious. To know that it says Laman Yitavloch in the second Dibras is very easy to realize that it doesn't say it in the first, and in fact that it doesn't say the word Toiv or even have the letter Tes anywhere in the first Dibras, that might take a little more thinking into. So that could be one of the many answers. Again, there are many answers that have been brought on this. Many of the Mephoshim talk about the idea. He's not talking about the actual word, whether it says Laman Yitav Loch in the second Dibras. Of course he knows that it says that, and that it doesn't say it in the first Dibras. But rather, the question is, for example, Pnei Yeshua has a long arichus over here where he explains basically like this. Now we know there are a number of variations between the first dibris and the second. For example, in the first dibris we have Zachar Siyam HaShabbos, and in the second one Shomer Siyam HaShabbos. And what do we say? That they were both said b'dibracha. They were both said at once by Hashem. Now, so that can apply to all the different variations over there, but here we have a variation where we have extra words that are in there in verse Hanan that are not there in Yisrael. Therefore, that becomes the question, Pnei Yeshua explains, is it that, in fact, Hashem did not say them, that Hashem did not say them, and Moshe added them when he was telling over the Aseret HaDibros to the Jewish people in Parshas Vaaschanan, or did Hashem say them, and just maybe they weren't written on the Luchos? So therefore, he's saying, so when he says Shaleini im nemar behen Torah im lav, he doesn't mean do we open up a Sefer Torah and look in Parshas Vaaschanan and see whether it says the word Torah. Of course it says. The question is, was it actually something that Hashem said there at Har Sinai and was written on the Luchos, or was it not? The Aruch HaNer gives an explanation that he's saying the question is basically what kind you're saying that it says toiv, but keep in mind the actual pasuk is l'man yitav loch, where arguably toiv means the ultimate good, meaning implying in other words good in olam haba, whereas l'man yitav loch on the face of it would mean something in this world. So he's saying, I don't know, when it says yitav loch, does it mean just in this world, or does it mean that you're saying that it says in the second gibris toiv, does it actually mean the toiv of olam haba, or does it mean a lesser toiv than that, the kind that's expressed only in l'man yitav loch? And then there's a variety of explanations that go along the lines of the chlal. The question is, when we say that when we have the two different versions of the Dibris, is it that one was written on the first Luchos and the other was written on the second Luchos? Or is it that the first and second Luchos had exactly the same wording, and the only difference is that in Vaaschanan, when Moshe is telling it over, then he sort of editorialized and added in places where he needs to clarify things for the Jewish people. So then that would be part of the question also. He's asking, why is it by the Luchos Rishon, but Dibris Rishonis versus Dibris Achronis, implying, in other words, that he's understanding that these are actually different versions of the Dibris that were written on the different Luchos, and Rav Chiya bar Abba is telling him, I don't know whether that's in fact the case, or whether the same exact Dibris were written on the first ones and on the second ones. Anyways, there are many, many other different explanations, and in all genres of Torah. You have explanations according to Pshat, explanations according to Remez, according to Drush, according to Soid, of what exactly the Priya Ba'ava means over here. This that was saying that it says Tov the second time in Parshas Vaaschanan, Bala Turim points out over there, not only that, first of all, like we're saying, there's no letter Tess at all in the first, in the Dibris in Parshas Yisrael, only in Vaaschanan, but in addition, Bala Turim points out, actually there are 17 extra words in the Dibris in Parshas Vaaschanan, where 17 is the Gematria of Tov, so that further underscores this point, that there's a certain Tov over there that you don't have in the ones in Parshas Yisrael. Anyway, so again, Rav Chanina bar Ogil is asking why that's so. Rav Chiya bar Abba tells him that I don't know if it's necessarily so. Anyway, so he says, "Kloch etzer Rav Tanchum b'chaniloi, show your Rogel etzer Rav Yishuv and Levi. Go ask Rav Tanchum b'chaniloi. He used to regularly learn by Rav Yishuv and Levi, show your Baki b'agada. And Rav Yishuv and Levi, in turn, was expert in Agada, in Agada. So therefore, so you can expect that Rav Tanchum b'chaniloi will be familiar, will know an answer to this as well. So Ozul Agabe, so Rav Chanina bar Ogil goes to ask him. Omalei, so he says, Rav Tanchum says, Mimenu loy shamaiti, I didn't actually hear anything from Rav Yishuv and Levi on this, but Ela kach omli Shmuel bar Nochum, but Shmuel bar Nochum told me, and this Shmuel bar Nochum is Achi Imoy Shorab Achab Rav Chanina. He is the uncle, the mother's brother of Rav Achab Rav Chanina. Apparently, he had to identify him because I guess Shmuel bar Nochum himself was not as well known. But Amila Avi Imo should have Achi Rav Chanina. Others say that what he told him is that the Shmuel bar Nochum is the grandfather of Rav Achi Rav Chanina. Anyway, he told me the reason it doesn't say Toiv, or even that it has the letter Tess at all in the Dibris in Parashas Yisrael, Hoyov Soifam Lishtaber, because in the end, the first Luchos were going to be broken. So Hashem knew in advance that that's going to happen, therefore he didn't want to write the word Toiv in there. So the Gemara says, okay, the luchas, the first luchas are going to be broken. What does that have to do with not writing the word toiv or any form of the word over there? Amar Rav Ashi, chas v'shalom, poska toiv v'Yisrael. So Rav Ashi says, because if the word toiv, or even the letter tes, had been on the first dibris, then when they were broken, on the first luchas, then when they were broken, it would have symbolized that chas v'shalom, there were goodness would cease from the Jewish people. As if like together with the breaking of the luchas, that the tes, and what it symbolizes, which the Gemara is going to go on to say now, that tes symbolizes toiv, good, then that would have been gone. So therefore, Hashem didn't write it on there in the first place in order to avoid that problem. So Marsha explains, in other words, the point is that it hints at the idea like this. We have Tibud Avraham is one of the mitzvahs that have that Ocho Per is saying ba'olam azeh va'keren payimus la'olam haba. If the test had been on there, and then it would have been broken off, then it would have represented that there would only be the payrus for it, and there wouldn't even be the payrus for it. They would have like this, the pasuk of Aman Yarichon Yamecha Al Hadama. It would mean that there wouldn't be that Arichos Yamim, that there wouldn't be that reward would get broken off. So by not having the letter test on there, it makes it that reward is able to be ba'olam hazeh, and the keren is still kayemes la'olam haba. Okay. More on this topic about the symbolism of the letter test. Amar Rabbi Yeshua, ha'roya test v'chaloy me'sivin yofaloy. If a person sees on the side of it here, it says maybe it's supposed to be Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, and we just said Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is an expert in Agadza, so that would fit. Anyway, he says, if a person sees a letter tes in his dream, simin yofaloi, then it's a good sign for him. Well, the Gemara says, my time, what's so great about the letter tes? You're going to say because it's the initial of the word toiv, fine, but it's also the initial of something negative. Ema, you could instead say the test represents the apostle talking about the destruction of Babel, the tete tia b'matate hashmed. Hashem says, I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, meaning that Babel is going to be, the city of Babel is going to be completely and utterly destroyed. So, test stand, you have four tesses right there in those two words. Maybe the test is symbolizing that destruction. And the answer is chad test, Tamrin. Fine, we don't mean that he's seeing a whole line of tests. We mean he sees one individual test. The Gemara says, still, ema tum osa b'shuleha. Fine, but the test could just as well stand for the word tuma, as you have the pasuk in Eicha, the pasuk in the first capital of Eicha that begins with test. As we know, the first four prakim of Eicha are written according to the order of the Aleph Beis. And the test pasuk from the first capital begins tum osa b'shulecha. Her tumah is on the hems of her garments. The metaphor being the previous pasuk says that the Jewish people were like a nidda. So now it's as if like you have a nidda walking around with blood spattered on the hems of her garments, where everybody can see openly that she's tumah. So then maybe the test in the person's dream represents that. And the answer is test base, Kamrinan. Fine, we don't mean that he sees just the letter test by itself. We mean he sees a test in a base. Well, that's most of the word toiv. It's the shortish of the word toiv. So therefore, that can't mean tumasa b'sholeha, because there's no base in the word tumasa. There is, though, the word b'sholeha, of course, because of the base, but that's already the next word, so it's not meant to represent that. Still, Gemara says, ema tovu ba'aretz shahareh. Okay, you have this in the second parak of Eicha. The test pasuk begins with a test in a base. Tovu va'aretz shahareha, the gates of the Beis Mikdash sank into the ground. So also a test is representing something negative. So what's Rabbi Yeshua's basis for saying that a test in a dream symbolizes something good? So Ella, no, the answer is never mind this business about one test versus multiple ones or tests versus test bays. The letter test by itself, we're going back to what he said originally, the letter test by itself automatically represents something good. Why? Because the Torah first uses the word test in connection with good. The very first test that you have in the Torah is the test in the word toiv. Therefore, the test by itself represents good, and the fact that later on that letter tes is used to represent other things as well, tumasa and tovu ba'aretz sha'areha and betetetia and so forth, is neither here nor there. So yes, to see a tes in a dream by itself is a very good thing. Marshall gives a fascinating explanation over here that ties in. So what happened with what was the history of Sefer Eicha, of Megillas Eicha? So the Gemara elsewhere tells us that, and then Rashi brings it on the Psukim in Eicha, that originally Yirmiya was told by Hashem to write Perek Aleph Beis Dalad of Eicha. And the idea was bring it in front of King Jehoiakim and his noblemen. This was about 17 years before the Churban, and this way let them hear for the first time what is actually going to happen in great detail, and maybe that'll motivate them to do tshuva. So Yumi himself can't come and bring it. He sends his Talmud Baruch with the Kitzer, it's read to them, and Jehoiakim, instead of taking it seriously and doing tshuva, he cut it up and threw it in the fire. Then Hashem tells Yirmiya, rewrite it, and this time add something more to it. So what did he add? This time he added Peret Gimel, where Peret Gimel is a triple aleph base, so it corresponds to, like this you had three individual perukim before, like this Hashem told him to add one new peret that contains one new peret that contains a triple aleph bays. As far as Perek Hey, the Gemara doesn't discuss there when it was added. I think there are Mephoshim who say that maybe that one was added after the Churban. Whatever. The point is, Marshall explains like this. If you look in the original three kapitlach that he wrote. So again, the first one begins with a test pasuk, begins with Tumasa. The second one begins with Tavu Ba'aretz Sha'areha. Those correspond to the first two Batei Mikdash. Then you have the what we have now as the fourth parak, and in Yirmiyah's original was the third one. That one actually does begin with the word tovim. Tovim ha'yuchal lecherev. In context, the word tovim is used over there to describe the fate of the people who were killed. But still, it does begin with the word tovim, and therefore that symbolizes the third base mikdash, which is going to be tova, which is never going to be destroyed. So when he had to rewrite Megillas Eicha, then he added in the third perek, and in the third perek, all three psukim with tes begin with the word toiv. Toiv lagever ki yisa ol ben urav, toiv yachol v'dumam, whatever. Anyway, all three of them begin with toiv. So therefore, and on top of that, the churban took place on tes, on Tisha B'Av. So therefore, so now Marashah ties all of this together when the Gemara is saying the test shows goodness, but on the other hand, you could say that the fact is the luchas were broken. Maybe like the Gemara said before, Chas v'shalom poska tovam Yisrael. So to begin with, Yirmiyo forestalls that. Even in his original version of Megillas Eicha, he made sure that the third perek, the test pasuk, begins with the word toiv. And then when he rewrote it and added the third perek to correspond to the other two, he made sure that all three psukim in it begin with the word toiv. So now the Gemara is symbolizing that over here by saying that first it says the person sees a test in his dream, but maybe it means, we're saying it means toiv, maybe not, maybe it means something negative, like in that first parak maybe it means the tetetia of a matate, that means destruction. So then we say that no, it's only one test, okay, but maybe that's the first test of Eicha. Then he says test beis, representing the second test, but still the second parak also begins with something negative. So he says that no, ultimately what it is because Hashem put the letter test the first time in the Torah with the word toiv, then therefore that's symbolic of the fact that ultimately that is what toiv represents, and therefore then Peret Gimel and Dalad of Eicha, the test psukim, all begin with toiv, and therefore it represents that ultimately all of that negativity that we have represented in Sefer Eicha is all going to be transformed into good. It should be Mian Mamish. Since we're mentioning something about where a person sees a letter in a dream and it means something good. So similarly, Ba'om Rabbi Shor ben Levi points out another one as well. Haroya hesped b'chaloymoy, when a person sees in his dream a hesped, And it means the word hesped stands for chosu olav min hashamayim uf da'u. It means that that Hashem had rachmonus on him. The word hesped, we can darish in the hey as though it was a ches. We often find in Drashas of Chazal where they interchange hey and ches because they look very similar, and really they're also supposed to be pronounced very similar. We Ashkenazim don't pronounce them anything the same, but the Sfardim pronounce a ches back in the throat, a ches. So therefore, it's not that different than a hey. So the word hesped breaks down into chos, which means that Hashem had rachmanos, and pad malachit pedia. Very appropriate now is the year Tovshin Pei Dalet, should talk to be the year of our Pedus, the year that the Eveshter redeems us. Anyway, so here we're saying that here he sees a hesped in his dream. It represents these two words, chosu and pedu. Bahani mila b'ksava, that applies when he sees the word hesped in writing. So we don't mean that he sees an actual hesped in his dream. We mean that he sees the word hesped in writing, and therefore it breaks down to those two words, chos and poda. So in that case, then Marsha says, so then why doesn't he see chaspad? Why does he see it with a hey? He says, because after all, every dream has dvorim b'talim in it. So therefore, here's the dvorim b'talim, where instead of the expected ches, you have a hey. But nevertheless, that's what it represents. Different other mafoshim talk about the point that when a person sees a hesped in a dream, it's meant to make him feel to realize his mortality. So therefore that itself helps him do tshuva, and that itself makes him that Hashem will have rachmanos on him. Ben Yehoyada points out that it means basically like this: he sees the word hesped, he's gonna start feeling bad about it, he's gonna go to a chacham to interpret it, and then the chacham will do the explanation for good by transforming the hay into a ches. And that way, also the fact that he had to go through that itself will be part of his kapara that will help him. That attacker should be good. Okay. Getting back to, we said in the Mishnah, v'chein chaya v'oif kayotz v'hen v'chola, we said the same way as the dinim, all the dinim we mentioned in the Mishnah, as far as bur, and as far as hafroshas harsina, and tashlume kefal, and so on and so forth, we said they apply not only to shur v'chamur, they apply to any kind of domestic animal. So the Mishnah had said, v'chein chaya v'oif kayotz v'hen, the same way. We said the same way wild animals and birds, you also have the same rules, as far as not working with them on Shabbos, and that they have to be kept off Har Sinai, and that you can't cross-breed them and so forth, all apply to wild animals and to birds as well. So Omer Rish Lakish, Kan Shona Rebbe. So Rish Lakish says, in this connection, Rebbe taught us, meaning that we can derive from the Mishnah the point, Tarnagol Tavos Uprisyoni Kilayim Zebazeh, a chicken. Tarnagol is a chicken, Tavos is a peacock, and Pisioni, whatever, is a type of quail or a type of pheasant. Rashi actually translates over here by a French word that in English means partridge. So whatever, these are all closely related species of birds. We just had last night in Ein Yaakov, we were talking about the slav and the Gemara, the slav from the Midbar, and the Gemara mentions that there are actually four birds in the slav family, of which one of them is Pisioni that's mentioned over here. So it's a bird in that family. In English, it's called partridge. Anyway, the point is, all three of those, as Shlokesh is saying, are kilayim with one another. So you wouldn't be able to crossbreed any two of those, and you wouldn't be able to, for example, hitch two of them up to pull something or something like that. The point is, Tosfos says, what Rish Lakish means by that is, without Rebbe having told us in this Mishnah that kilayim applies to birds, you wouldn't have known it. In Mishnayos Kilayim, it doesn't mention that point. It mentions that it applies to behemoths and chayas, so you wouldn't have known that it applies to birds. Now, when it says over here in our Mishnah that it applies to birds, then we understand, therefore, that it means that these are considered three separate species, even though they do often live together in the wild. And the Ravid adds, not only that, they even will take care of each other's eggs. If you take eggs from a chicken and put them by a peacock, it will hatch them and it will raise the children. And similarly with the other ones, you would think that's enough for them to be considered one species. No, Rish Lakish is saying the fact is they have very different characteristics, and therefore, and because Rebbe tells us here in the Mishnah that kilayim applies to birds, then therefore we understand it applies to them as well. Well, that's what Gemara says. Pshita, wouldn't it be obvious? Obviously, they look very different. And the answer is Amar Rav Chaviva, Mishum the Rovu Bahadi Adadi. Exactly that, like we just said, because they do grow together, they do live together in the wild, and even as the Ravid says, they will even raise each other's eggs and chicks. So therefore, you would think that, so Maor Tema, Min Chadu, so you would think they're all considered one min, Kamash Malan, and therefore Rish Lakish is telling us that no, they are in fact considered separate minim, and therefore we have all the dinim of Kalayim applied to them. Next, in this connection, talking about Kilayim of birds, Omer of Chaviva, Omer Shmuel, Avos Abur Kilayim Zebezer. Shmuel says a domestic goose and a wild goose are Kilayim with one another. Now, we often have, when it comes to the Dinim of Kilayim, many times we say that the domesticated and the wild versions of a certain animal or plant or whatever are not considered Kilayim. But here, as the Gemara is going to go on to discuss, there is enough difference between the domestic goose and the wild goose that they do, that they are considered Kilayim. So we have to figure out what that difference is. Maskifla Rava Barachonim. My time. Why should they be Kilayim? Are you going to say because one has a long beak and the other one has a short beak, and that's reason enough to consider them different species? Elamayata, by that logic, then what are you going to say? Gamla Parasev, Gamla Taya. What about a Persian camel versus an Arab camel? You have, you look at pictures, you have Arabian camels, which are the kind that have one hump. And they generally have, they have a very thin neck relative to their, to the size of their body. Then you have the other kind, which they call, in English, it's called a Bactrian camel. Bactria is an area in what's now in Afghanistan. Back then it was ruled over by Persia, where those camels generally have two humps and they have a much thicker neck. So by that logic, the high alim kui, the high cotton kui, one has a thick neck and the other one has a thin neck. You're going to say the same thing that an Arabian camel and a Bactrian camel are Kilayim with one another? And the Gemara knows as a given that they're not. So why should we assume, just because the domestic goose and the wild goose have different shaped beaks, why should we assume that they're different enough to be considered Kilayim? It's interesting, by the way, that here the Gemara is using the word kue first, and Rashi translates it as a beak when it comes to the birds, and then when it comes to the animals, the camels, obviously it's not a beak, so there it means, it would have to mean their neck. Rashi, in fact, so it's the same word, kue, but first we're using it for beak, and then we're using it for neck. So maybe the word kue in general means whatever the animal eats with. In the case of a bird, it eats with its beak, and with an animal, it eats, the food goes down its throat, down its neck. I don't know. For that matter, the Gemara may mean, when it says avas and avas abor over here, maybe, for example, it means like a goose and a swan, which are fairly closely related, but a swan has a much longer neck. So maybe, therefore, arich kue means not only it has a longer beak, which a swan does, but also a longer neck. What is it about the two kinds of birds that makes them collide? Ella amar abaya, zeh beitzav mibachutz v'zeh beitzav mibifnim. The difference is one of them has its beitzim on the testicles on the outside, and the other one has them on the inside. Most birds, in other words, most birds don't have external genitals. They have a thing over there called a cloaca, which basically they use it for both excreting the waste and for fertilizing and laying eggs and whatnot. But you have certain kinds of birds that do have external genitals, and we're saying that the difference is between an avos and an avos abur. One of them, Rashi explains, the wild goose you can see the genitals from the outside. The domestic one you can't. So that's reason enough to consider them different. Rapapa points out there's another difference also as far as how many children, how many eggs they lay at a time. Another difference is that the wild goose only lays one egg at a time. Only after it's laid the first egg, only then does it start developing another egg, and eventually it'll lay that one, as opposed to the domestic goose lays a few eggs at a time. Different birds are like that. A domestic goose. Yeah, different birds are like that. Some birds lay a bunch of eggs at a time. Some of them lay only one egg at a time, and they start on the next one. So that's another difference, and therefore that's another reason to say that they're obviously different enough species to be collided. Okay. More on the topic of Tulaim. Omer of Yumya, Omer of Shlokish. This, by the way, I mean, all of this is really belongs, of course, to Masechta Kilayim, but since Masechta Kilayim is one of the Masechtas in Seder Zeroyim that doesn't have Gemara Bavli, so now when the Gemara here in the Bavli has an opportunity to talk about Kilayim, then it goes through with it. So Omer of Yumya, Omer of Shlokish, Hamarbiya Shnei Minim Shabayam Loike. If a person were to cross breed two types of creatures that live in the sea, then he would get Malchus. Now, my time. Now, the question is why? We said in the Mishnah that we're learning from the Dinim of Shabbos. We're learning because it says we said Kilayim. We said applies to other kinds of creatures as well. Because we said we're learning by Zeta Shava on the word Shur or on the word Behemtecha from Shabbos, as far as crossbreeding and as far as pulling wagons or whatever, respectively. But Tosfos points out that you can't really learn from Shabbos to that because we don't, again, we talked about yesterday, the Isser of making animals work on Shabbos is called Mechamer Acha Behemta, where the person is Mechamer, like he's leading the animal like you would lead a donkey. So like he's walking behind the animal and goading it to go in the direction that he needs to, carrying his packages or whatever, that kind of thing. A donkey driver like that is called Mechamer. So you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Fish and sea creatures, you don't usually do that with. So we can't necessarily learn from Shabbos to Kilayim that it should be Osir. So the question is, why indeed are we saying that it is Osir, and that he's even getting Malchus? So they mean that it's not just Dirabbanan, it's actually Daraisa. So Omer of Adaba Ava, Mishmeda Ula, Asya Laminehu, Laminehu Miyabosha. Because we have Xerah Shava on the word Laminehu from the land creatures, both by the land creatures and by the water creatures, which were created, the water creatures on the fifth day of Maaseh Bereishis, the land animals on the sixth one. By both of them, it says Hashem created them Laminehu, and therefore that means the same rule of Laminehu, the same rule that Hashem wants the species to be kept separate and not crossbred and not used to yoke together or whatever. The same thing is going to apply to sea creatures as well. So fish, dolphins, walruses, etc. In fact, Tosfos brings over here brings a girsa from one of the Balei HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Rabbi Yehuda, who said that actually the Gemara shouldn't be saying Hamarbia, that he crossbreeds them, rather it should be saying Hamanhig, where he has two of them pull a boat or something together, because he points out fish don't mate in the same way that land animals do. You don't have, there's no mating where one inserts into the other one. Rather, with fish, the way it is, you know, the female lays eggs and then the male fertilizes them externally. So how can you be talking about mybia? How can you be talking about crossbreeding them? However, Tosfos says you don't really have to correct it because, after all, sea creatures include more than just fish. Yeah, you have different, you have walruses, you have seals, you have creatures like that spend some of their time on dry land. They mate and they mate in the normal way as other animals do. Yeah, even Tosfos doesn't mention it, but the fact is you have also, there are sea mammals that spend their entire lives in the water, like whales and dolphins and whatnot, and they also mate, back, front to back, like animals do. So therefore, so it is reasonable. So the Gemara can well be talking about Hamabia, where a person crossbreeds them, yeah. Okay. Boy Rachva. So now Rachva asks in this connection, Hamanik b'iza b'shibuta ma'am. What would happen if a person were to be, let's say, for example, pulling a boat or a wagon or something using a goat and a shibuta? Shibuta is a kind of fish. It's a kind of fish. In fact, elsewhere, Tosfos defines it as the goat of the sea. You know, the Gemara tells us in Cholin that every creature on dry land has an analog in the water, except for the Gemara mentions the Cholda, which is a weasel or a rat, or some creature like that. So the shibuta is the parallel to the goat on land, is the parallel in the water. The Gemara mentions in Cholin in a different context as well that the shibuta is an example of one of those things where Hashem created something mutter in the world to correspond to something osir, that the brain, I think it is, of the shibuta tastes like chazer flesh, and therefore so a person can actually enjoy the taste of it in a kosher way. Anyway, the point is, over here, the question is, suppose a person hitches up a wagon or a boat or something like that to a goat on dry land and a shibuta in the water.
Or a goat in low water.
Yeah, whatever. The point is, in other words, so the question is, Mahu, what would be the din? Would he get Malchus for that? Do we say each one lives in their own element? The goat never goes into the water. Okay, like you said, you know, it can be splashing in shallow water, but it doesn't go, it doesn't swim in the water after all. And the shibuta never goes onto dry land. So maybe what he's doing doesn't matter. Maybe it's not considered kilayim. Or maybe the fact is he is right now leading of his wagon or his boat or whatever with two different animals. So Ravina asks, what's even the question? Why should you think that there's an issue of kilayim over here when they're in two different places? Ravina says, element after, by your logic that you're even asking the question, imagine a person takes a grain of wheat and a grain of barley in his hand. He plants the wheat grain in Eretz Yisrael. He has like a plot of land right there on the border between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz, and he plants the wheat grain on one side of the border and the barley grain right there on the other side of the border within a couple of tefachim of one another. You need between one min and another, you generally need three tefachim with certain exceptions. So here he planted the two of them, a tefach or two apart, and one's in Eretz Yisrael and one in Chutz La'aretz. So Ravina is saying, are you going to think he's chayev? Obviously not, because one is in a place where you're chayev, and one because Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz are two separate places. So the same thing over here, the goat is in one place on the dry land and it remains there. The shibuta is in another place in the water and it never goes out of there. So what's the haba? I'm in it to think that there would be any issue. Amri, so they answer back, Hochi Hashta, how are you thinking to compare the two cases? The difference is, Eretz Yisrael is a place where you have the chiyuv, where you have the iser of kelai zroim. At least in that Torah. Midrabanan, maybe it applies in Chutz La'aretz as well, but at least, but midaraisa, it applies only in Eretz Yisrael. So you're talking about one of these seeds that you planted is in a place where there's a chiyuv and the other one is not. Here, both places, the fact is, we said before that if you're marbia or manhig, if you crossbreed or yoke together two water creatures of different minim, then you are chayev. And similarly, if you do it with two land animals, you're chayev. So in each case, you are talking about a place of chiyuv. It's not like you have one is in a place of chiyuv and the other not, unlike with the case of the two seeds. So maybe there is reason taka to be machayev. So the Maisa, the halacha is, you're not allowed to do it, but a person does do it, he doesn't get malchus, because the Gemara has left it as a suffix. With the goat and the shibuta.
Okay, nice to have a goat in low water, pulling together with a water.
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be in low water. You have, for example, you have, let's say, a barge, is a type of boat that goes in shallow rivers, right. And they actually have people or animals pulling it with ropes. You have, instead of it floating in the water, you actually have people or animals pulling it with ropes on the side. So conceivably, you could have, let's say, the goat on dry land, and meanwhile, shibuta in the water are both pulling it. Rashi gives the example over here with a wagon. So you'd have a wagon where you have one rope of it going to a goat on dry land, and then you have another one going to a shibuta in the water. So we're saying you're not allowed to do that, but if a person does do it, he doesn't get malchus because the Gemara has left it as a solid. Hadron alach shor shenogach hasapara. For some people, I guess it may be the first time since sixth grade that they're learning it, but no, we learned it together 7 years ago. Anyway, the subject of this perek is the beginning of the perek talks about the dinim of Shein V'Regel, and then the end of the perek talks about the dinim of H, and then that way we've covered all our Baal Ovis Nezikin, because we had Shur, which we discussed extensively in the previous perekim, Bur we just had at the end of the previous perek. Then we had Mave, which we had the different opinions, what Mave is. We had the opinion that Mave is Shein, and then we're going to be covering it now. And then we had the other opinion that Mave is a Odom, in which case we're going to be talking about that in the following Prokim, and Heber, which is fire.
So Mave doesn't mean carrying a fire over someone?
No, that's Mav-ir. Mav-er, we said at the beginning of the Masechta, we said we had two opinions, Rav and Shmuel, whether it's Mav-er Ze'odom, does it mean a person causing damage, or does it mean the tooth of an animal causing damage? The Gemara is going to bring further down on the Amud the opinion that says that Mav-er referred the Gemara is going to bring further down the Amud, Sukkim, where we learned Shein and Regel from, which we learned back at the beginning of the Masechta as well. But, so now we'll have covered all of them.
Let's show you some Mav-er.
the Shardish Amava. We said over there, it can mean the seeker, so therefore it means a person who's seeking out things, and it can mean the one that's uncovered, as we said, because the tooth is sometimes the tooth, the teeth of an animal are sometimes covered and sometimes uncovered. Tosfos points out now in the second half of Perek Gimel and all of Perek Dalet and all of Perek Hay talk about dinim of most at the beginning of Perek Hay rather talk about dinim involving damages by an animal. Why didn't we put this over there? Why did we wait? Why did we first stick in burr and now we're getting back to damages by animals? So Tosfos explains because in the previous Perek we had a case where a shur falls into a burr and dirties the water. Therefore, that led the Mishnah into talking about the dinim of burr while we're at it. And also Tosfos says that because the beginning of our Mishnah is really going to focus, our Mishnah is going to focus more on the degree of shmira. What degree of watching do you have to do, of guarding the animal do you have to do to be potter? So the Tanna figured first let's deal with burr, with the actual nezakin of burr, before we deal really with the level of shmira that a person has to do to prevent the nezak from happening in the first place. Then he mentions also that we did have in the Mishnah in the previous Perek the case where the person covered the burr properly. So now our Mishnah continues in that vein, talking about where the person locked up the door properly in front of the animal versus where he did not. And then at the end of the Perek, we're going to talk about the dinim of Eish. So the Mishnah starts off Hakoinis Soin Ladir. When a person gathers together his sheep into a pen. Which now a deer, the Meiri points out, typically in Gemara terminology, a deer is not a permanent place where you keep the animals. It's more of a temporary enclosure that you have. You have a field that you want to be fertilized, so you keep the sheep in it for a while, so their droppings will fertilize the field, and you build a temporary deer for them over there. So you do that. The knob for now koroi, and he closed the door properly in front of it, and we'll see in the Gemara what koroi means. The yotz of izika, and the animal went out and caused damage. So for example, the door, the Gemara is going to tell us that koroi means you have a door that's strong enough to withstand ruach mitsuya, or whatever other kind of common hazards that you have in that area. So now, if it fell off the ruach she'en mitsuya, and the sheep went out, then he's potter because he did proper sheep. Loy knob for now karoi, but if you didn't close it properly, the yotzavi zika, and it went out and caused damage, chayev, then he's going to be chayev because he didn't do proper shmira. Nifritz of alayla, if the door of the, or the wall of the pen was broken open at night, and Tosfos points out, there's a couple of possibilities. Why it happened, we're not really concerned how exactly it happened, but why are we mentioning at night? So Tosfos refers to actually that, if we learned it back in the first parak, if it happened by day, then maybe there would be more reason to be mechayev him because then there's a coil for it. Like this one, it happens at night. He may not hear about it for a while. So therefore, then you don't expect him to be standing guard over there. So therefore he's potter. So if it happened at night, so that's the, and Tosfos says, another point is also, if it's at night, even if he does find out about it, we're not necessarily matriach him to schlep out there at night in order to close it up again. So therefore, that would be reason enough to be potter, because it happened by night. Continues the Mishnah. Oisha Pratsua listing. Or robbers broke open, or robbers broke open the gate, the yotz of Izika, and the animal went out and caused damage. Potter, then the owner of the sheep is potter because again he did what he was supposed to, and it's not his fault that it got broken open. Now Tosfos says that actually in that case the listim would also be potter because if they didn't take out the animal. The Mishnah is next going to continue what happens if they did take out the animal, but Tosfos learns if the listim only broke open the gate and they didn't do anything else, then if the animal goes out, everybody's potter, both the owner because he didn't do anything wrong and the listim because they didn't take it out. Now, the Rambam actually disagrees with that point. The Rambam, based on the Gemara further down, The Rambam draws a distinction basically between what was the intention of the person in breaking open the gate. Was he intending to steal the animal? Then in that case, you could say, fine, similar to what Tosfos said. The fact is, they didn't steal the animal, therefore they can't be chayav for it. Drusus says, when they broke open the gate with the intention that the animal should go out and cause damage, and then the owner of the animal is going to be chayav, then we can be chayav them for that.
But either way, they caused the animal to block.
They caused the animals to go out, but it's sort of grunt, though. It's not really a direct thing. So again, if they took out the animals, then the Mishnah is going to go on to say they become chayiv for the nezakin of the animals, but otherwise not. But again, according to Tosfos, that's always, according to Rashi and Tosfos, that's always the case across the board. According to the Rambam, it'll really depend what their motivation was in breaking down the door or the fence in the first place. Continues the Mishnah. If the owner of the animal left the animal in the sun, and therefore the sun, the heat and the sun is bothering the animal, so therefore, even if you lock up the door properly, that's no good. The animal is going to try to break through because it wants to get out of it, wants to get out of the heat. I skipped a line in the Mishnah. If the robbers actually took out the animals from the pen, and then it caused damage, listim chayavim, then the listim are chayav for the damages of the animal, because in effect what it is then therefore in that sense they were sort of koina the animal. We're going to talk about in much greater detail later in the Masechta, the dinim of when a ganav is koina the thing that he stole and when he doesn't. But here we're not saying they're actually koina the animal in a full-fledged way. They still have to return the actual animal itself, but nevertheless they're chayav for its nizakin. Continues the Mishnah. He nicha b'chama, if the owner of the animal left it in the sun, or he gave it to watch to a cheres shoyt of a cotton, and they're not capable of watching it properly, and went out and caused damage, chayev, then in those cases, it's going to be chayev, because that was pia to leave it out in the sun, or to give it to a cheres shoyt of a cotton to watch. Masra l'roya, if instead he gives over the animal to a shepherd to watch, and the shepherd is a regular ben das, then the shepherd takes over for him, right. And now then takes over responsibility. And now, if the animal causes damage, then the shepherd is going to be chayav. Continues the Mishnah. Nafla legina. Suppose that the animal fell into somebody's garden. So Rashi gives an example. It was on top of the roof, and it fell into a garden that was next door. Rashi gives another example. The Rishos Rabbah might be higher than the garden. Sometimes you have, you see, and then in some places in the world, you have the street is high up, and then people's front lawns and things slope down. Anyway, so here it fell into somebody's garden. These venemis, and it had hana, and we'll see in the Gemara eventually what kind of hana do we mean that it ate, or do we mean the hana that it landed on something soft and then didn't break all its bones. We'll discuss that in the Gemara in a couple of days. Best Hashem. Mishalemis, mashanemis, then you pay, the owner of the animal pays for what it had hana. Meaning, in other words, so we're talking about that. So Rashi explains it over here according to the possibility that it means that it fell and it had a soft fall rather than a hard one. So Beis Din will evaluate how much a person would be willing to pay for such a thing for there to be something soft for his animal to fall on rather than something hard, and that's the amount he pays regardless of the actual value of the produce that it damaged.
About the lunch, yeah.
So the lunch is something else that we're going to deal with. But right now, we're talking about the mashananis, means, in other words, that he's paying. The point is that here it was an oinus that it came in there in the first place, because it didn't deliberately go in there. Therefore, he's paying the lesser amount, mashananis. On the other hand, this is similar to what we learned back in the second parak. As far as the dinim of Shane, we talked about there's a difference between whether the animal eats in the street or at the side of the street or inside the store or outside or whatever, where we said there's a difference also between mashananis and mashizika. Sometimes you factor in only what you, the owner, gain from the fact that now you don't have to feed the animal its next meal, which would mean, in other words, you're not paying the full value, you're paying the value of an equivalent amount of straw or something like that, as opposed to sometimes you pay mashizika. We said sometimes you pay the actual full value of the thing it ate. So here, in a similar vein, we're saying you only pay mashananis. Even so, these tomatoes that the animal fell on are worth $100. But in terms of how much would you be willing to pay that it shouldn't fall and break its bones, would be $50. That Beis Din will figure that out, and therefore he's paying only $50. Yoda Kedauka Vizika. On the other hand, if the animal went into the garden the normal way and then it caused damage over there, Shane Verego, Michelle Lemus Masha Hizika. Then you pay the full amount of the Hezek. You don't do based on Masha Nets. Kate and Michelle Lemus Masha Hizika. Now, how do we pay for what? How do we evaluate the amount that it, how do we amount the amount of the damage? Now the problem with the point of the question is, if we, now you have, let's say, for example, the animal went and ate all of the, all, everything that was growing in one plot of the land. Now, we learned before, we learned a week or two back that the problem with that is, if you were to evaluate that plot all by itself, it would come out a much higher price, because when would you sell such a small plot is only to a poor person who can't afford to buy something more, and you charge him extra because you're selling him only a small amount. So instead, we have to evaluate it relative to the rest of the field. So what we do is shaman base sub osasada. We figure out the value of a base sub, which is an area of 50 by 50 amas in that field. How much was that area worth before the animal got in there versus how much is it worth after the animal got done with it? The point being, in other words, if you have a base saw, you have 2,500 square amas. So let's say the price of such a thing, such an area, let's say, for example, with the crops in it, might go for $100. So now you have, let's say, the animal ate, let's say, 100 square amas out of it. So instead of calculating the value of the actual produce that grew in that 100 square amas, we're going to say, well, like this, it's 1/25th of the whole area. So now what would happen if a person had a choice of buying two base suds, one of which has 100% of the produce in it and the other has 96%, he wouldn't necessarily pay only 96%. He'd pay a little more, because basically he's getting a whole area. There's just a little area in it that was damaged. So that's how we do, and therefore it comes out a bit of a cooler for the mazik. He's not paying, that he's paying the value of it relative to the rest of the field. That there would only be when a person is selling a complete field and part of it has been damaged, the seller, of course, is going to get some discount, but he's not going to say, I want a full discount for the entire, I want it prorated for the entire amount. He might, let's say, pay 97 or 98% of the value rather than,
The guy who's doing the damage.
So the mazik is gaining a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not really gaining. He's not losing as much as he otherwise would.
So it's the opposite of the other guy, because he's paying him for a full field.
He's not paying for a full field. He's paying for the percentage. How much, if you wanted to sell this field and there's damage to part of it from the animal eating, how much of a discount would a potential buyer expect because of that damage?
He wouldn't. No discount.
So it's not that there'd be no discount. There'd be some discount, but it wouldn't be very much. So therefore, he might take off a few dollars. So therefore, that would be the amount. So that would be the amount the mazik pays. On the other hand, Reb Shimon Omer, Ochel Peiris Gmurim, Mishalem is Peiris Gmurim. Reb Shimon says it depends. If it ate produce that was completely ripe, then he paid Mishalem is Peiris Gmurim. Then you pay according to the value of the actual fully ripened produce. Im sa, vim sa'ayim sa'ayim. If it ate a sa, you're paying for the value of full sa. Two saw, you're paying for two saw, meaning the Tanakhama is saying it doesn't matter whether the produce was completely ripened yet or not. Either way, you figure it out. Al gav karka, you figure it out, like we said, what would be the value of the entire field full of produce, and how much would it be worth now that some of the produce is gone. You have to remember, when the produce is not ripe yet, you never know, for example, is all of it going to become ripe? Not necessarily. Some of it might be damaged at one time or another by something else. So therefore, that alone, then another person who's going to go buy it is not necessarily going to buy at full price anyway. But Reb Shimon is saying, once the produce is fully ripe, and therefore it doesn't really need to be attached to the ground anymore, then you don't consider it as part of the ground. Now you consider the same way as if the animal were to go in and eat, and a guy has a box of fruit on his counter, and then an animal goes in and eats that box of fruit. He's going to be paying the value of the actual fruit. Not al gav karka. Reb Shimon says the same thing when it is still attached to the ground, but it's already ripe and it doesn't need to be attached to the ground anymore. Later on in the parak, we're going to deal with why Reb Shimon says that and why the Chacham disagree with him. So the Gemara starts off. Tanabon, ezehu koroi veezehu shalai koroi. When we said at the beginning of the Mishnah that the person guarded the animal koroi the proper way or not koroi, what's the definition of that? So delos shechol lamed beruach mitzuya. When the door is strong enough to be able to withstand the normal wind or whatever kind of normal circumstances you have in this area, then zehu karoi. That's considered karoi, and therefore now if the animal went out, then he's potter. She'eni yechol lamed beruach mitzuya. But if it's not able to withstand even a normal wind, zehu shaloi karoi, then that's considered shaloi karoi, and now he'd be chasta. Well, the Gemara says, "Amar Rav Mani bar Patish, man tana moored disagile b'shmira pusa." Which tana would it be that would say that when an animal is moored, it's enough to do this kind of shmira pusa to just put up a door that will withstand the ruach mitsuya and no more than that? Because after all, when it comes to shein v'regel, as we've learned, an animal is always moored for those. Only by keren do we say there's tam, and then eventually it becomes moored. By shein v'regel, the animal is always moored to do those in the first place.
Kicking or
not kicking? Kicking is part of keren. Stepping on things and the normal way of walking and breaking them or damaging them and eating, those are things an animal does all the time. So therefore, the animal is moored for them to begin with. Which tana would it be that says that shmira pchusa, that a lesser kind of shmira, just putting up a door that will withstand beruach mitsuya, is enough to pater him for that? That would be Rabbi Yehuda. That would be according to Rabbi Yehuda. To Tanan, as we learned at the end of the fourth parak, Koshred Baila B'Maseira, we said when it comes to a shur, if the owner tied it up with a rope, with a gnaw lafon of karoi, or he locked the door properly in front of it, the yos of a hizik, and the animal still went out and went and damaged, Echad Tam V'Echad Mord Chayav Divid Ameir. Reb Meir says that whether the animal is a tam or a mord, he's chayav to pay, because according to the Meir, you need shmira ma'ula, you need a higher level of shmira in order to be potter. Reb Yehuda, I'm a tam chayav, a mord potter. Reb Yehuda had said, if the animal is tam, then you chayav, there you need shmira ma'ula, but a mord, you'd be potter, shenema, as the pasuk says, by a mord, v'lo yishmirenu ba'ala, the pasuk says, the owner didn't guard it, v'shamu huzeh, the fact is, here he did guard it, so therefore he's potter, even though it was only shmira posa. We discussed over there, we had Rabba Adab Abba versus Rab, does it mean that he's potter completely, or does it mean that he's only potter for the extra payment of a mord, but he's still chayav for the chatzi nezek of a tam? Do we say that Rabba Adab Abba said sad tamus from Koyma and Medis, the fact that it was a tam still remains, and that even though now it's a mord, and therefore he's still chayav for the chatzi nezek of a tam, and then we said Rab disagreed with that. We talked over there about the svara behind it. One point is, once the animal is moored, then other animals know to stay away from it. So whatever the case, we have reasons to say that. So that's Rabbi Yehuda has reason to say that based on the pasuk, and therefore that would apply to our Mishnah over here. Tosfos points out, now we did have the opinion of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov over there in the Gemara, and Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov had said that either a tam or a moored, or you need a shmirat pusa. So why doesn't the Gemara say that our Mishnah is like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov? And the reason is because our Mishnah is talking about sheep. Now, when it comes to sheep, you're not usually going to have kerem. To be sure, adult male sheep, the rams, have horns, but nevertheless, it's not very usual for them to gore with their horns. Mostly, what you're going to have with sheep is shein v'regel. And therefore, by them, it's only moored. Therefore, the Gemara is assuming we have to find a Tana who says specifically by moored that you only need shmira posa. So we had a third opinion over there in the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer in the Shmira El Sakin. Rabbi Eliezer had said the only proper Shmira for a sure mord is to shecht it with a knife, meaning, in other words, he said that even Shmira Ma'ula wouldn't be enough to pat to you, as we learned there. So the point is, our Mishnah would have to be like Rabbi Horda, says Ramani Bapatish. But the Gemara says not necessarily. Afilo Tamer Reb Meir, you could even say that our Mishnah goes like Reb Meir, and we would prefer to do that after all, because Stam Mishnah Reb Meir. The difference is shiny Shein V'Regel, that Torah Miyata B'Shmirasan. Shein V'Regel are different. There, the Torah clearly implies, as we're going to go on to say, that you don't need as much of a Shmira. So Reb Meir would hold as far as Keren, when the animal is Tam, then you need Shmira Ma'ola. But as far as Shein V'Regel, Reb Meir would say that whether the animal is Tam or whether Moored, you need Shmira Ma'ola. But when it comes to Shein V'Regel, Reb Meir would agree that you don't need Shmira Ma'ola, Shmira Pchusa, like we're saying over here, a door that will stand, but Ruach Matsuya is enough. Why is that? The Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Masnisa Tana, Rabbi Elazar says, if some say we learn in a Braisa, there are four things where the Torah implies that you only need a slight kind of Shmira. You only need a Shmira Pusa, and that's enough. Elohim, Bur V'Eish Shein V'Reg. Four kinds of Nizikin where Shmira Pusa, the Torah is saying, is enough. The pasuk describes that a person opens up a burr that was already there before and he removes the cover, or when he digs a new burr and he doesn't cover it, implying hakisahu potter, implying that if he covered it, he'd be potter. So implying you don't need it as long as you have a cover. Like we learned in the previous paragraph, for example, you have the foot traffic in this area is oxen, so you need a cover that will withstand oxen. You don't need something more than that, unless, like we said, camels sometimes come by. So we see that the bar shmir chuse is enough. Tosfa says, still, how do you know? Maybe the Torah is implying that you need a very, very strong cover. And the answer is because, if you had a very strong cover, first of all, Tosfos says a very strong cover would be practically the equivalent of filling in the burr. And we learned in the previous paragraph, the Torah doesn't require you to fill in the burr. It just requires you to cover it. So it can't be that means a super strong cover. It has to mean a cover that's good enough for the kind of animals that go by it. Also, Tosfos points out another point as well. Here, you have the Torah is equating two cases, one where a person digs a new burr, and the other one where a person opens a burr that was there before. Now, think of it. If you come by a burr, which is covered, and you uncover it, the Torah is requiring you to recover it. Is the Torah requiring you to make a whole new cover that's stronger than the one that's there before? No. As long as you take the cover that was there before and you put it back, then you're potter. The same way, we can't assume that when it comes to digging a new burr, that to begin with, you should be required to make that super strong cover. So therefore, that's another way of seeing that the pasuk is implying that all you need is shmirah posa. By burr. We're saying burr is one of the four examples where the Torah is telling you that shmirah posa is enough. That's what we're saying. There are four things. Burr, Eish, Shein, and Regel. We're going to go through now and show how with each one of them, the Torah is implying that Shemira Pose is enough.
If you get uncovered, then someone could really get hurt.
Well, that's what we're saying. All of these things, a person could get hurt. A person can get hurt. Nevertheless, we're saying as long as you cover it with a normal cover, you're not expected to put a cover that will withstand anything. By fire, the Torah says the one who set the fire will have to pay, implying why does it have to say hamaver? Ad ovid kein maver, only if he acts as a maver, as somebody who sets a fire carelessly. But in other words, as we're going to learn later on in the parak, if he starts a fire in his reshus and he's careful that there's a fire break around it, and then something happens, a ruach shein matsuya comes or whatever, and then spreads it, then he's not chayav for that. Not time at all, yeah, because then it was annoyance, yeah. Shein dechtivu vir b'steacher. Where do we see by Shein it's enough shmir posa? Because the pasuk says vir b'steacher. He swore he's in another field, ad be'ovid ke'en vir, only if he acts in a destructive way, or only if like he's letting his animals flee. But in other words, if he used shmir posa, like we're saying in our Mishnah, then he's potter if the animal did end up going out and doing damage. And regel dechtiv b'shilach, and by regel, because similarly, the pasuk is b'shilach, that he lets it go, ad be'ovid ke'en b'shilach, only if he acts in a way of letting it go rather than closing the door. And b'tanya, and we learn in a b'raisa, which we learned at the beginning of the Masechta, that b'shilach zeha regel, the word b'shilach in that pasuk refers to letting an animal loose and it goes and tramples things with its feet. As we find a pasuk that speaks of letting loose the feet of the ox and of the donkey and the ox, we had there it meant, in other words, it means the poshita meat, meaning the poshita thing that a person lets his animals loose. At the end of the first parak, we had a zirasha that we learned that it means about Yosef and Yisachar. Yisachar is compared to a donkey in this week's parasha. Yisachar hamer garim. Yosef is compared to a shur in Moshe's brachas in parashas of Zeresa bracha. And therefore, we learn from that that a person asher yashem zorei akamayim, a person is planting gmilas chasadim and learning Torah, then he's zoicha to the brachas of Yosef and of Yisachar. Anyway, the point is, we see that the word Meshalcha is used in connection with feet. The bracha with that Yisachar was like a donkey that he's able to carry heavy burden that Yisachar learns Torah. So, right. Uvir Zashen, and the word Uvir, destroying, refers to the animal eating with its teeth. As we find a pasuk that says, as the golol destroys until it's gone, we had three different explanations between Rashi and Tosfos how golol means that. Either that golol means waste, because that's what the animal produces from what it eats with its teeth, or that golol means uncovered, because the teeth are sometimes covered and sometimes uncovered, or because golol means marble, and the teeth resemble marble. Whatever the case, the point is, we see that the word yavir, the same shortage as uvir, is used in connection with teeth, so therefore we say that that's what uvir means, and it means shame. But the point is, again, only if he does uvir or v'shilach, where he lets them loose and doesn't even do shmir apkosa, then the Torah is telling us he's chayav, but when he does shmir apkosa, then he's sponsored. Well, Gemara asks
but
the Mishnah is saying even Shemir HaKosah is an Eflah. So time to Ovid Kain v'shilach Ovir, so only when he acts in a way of v'shilach Ovir, then he'd be chayev. So the Pasuk is implying Holoi Ovid Loi, implying that if he doesn't do that, if he does do Shemir HaKosah, then in fact he would be potter. And Omer Rabba Masnisin Nami Deka. In fact, you see this from the wording of the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah for the first time mentions sheep. Mechti b'shurkas skin and valsi. Throughout the previous parakim we've been talking about shur, nisni shur. So why doesn't our Mishnah say akon is shur the dude? Maishna dekatani tsoin. Lav mishum da turtum yetta b'shmirasan. Isn't that because this is an example of one of those kinds of things where the Torah says you don't need as much shmira? Again, like Tosfos said before, given that sheep don't usually gore with sheep, the main problem is shein v'regel, and therefore that would mean that even, we said that our Mishnah could be, even like Rameir would say when it comes to Keren, then you need shmira ma'ula when it comes to an animal. When it comes to shein v'regel, Rameir would agree that shmira p'chose is enough, and our Mishnah bears that out by using the example of tsoin. So that would show that it's an example of a Torah miyata b'shmirasan, and lav mishum dekan keren like sivabah. And after all, isn't it because when it comes to sheep, the Torah never talks about keren. Keren, the Torah always presents in connection with a shur. To be sure, if a sheep does do a hezek of keren, you're going to be chayav. We said that it applies to all animals. But practically speaking, a shur is usually the type to do this kind of damage. It's soin is not. Shein v'regel hu dichtivei. On the other hand, the Torah does talk about shein v'regel in connection with sheep. Kamash malon, the shein v'regel to mu'odin hu. So therefore, the Mishnah is implying only by shein v'regel, which are moored to begin with, then even a mayor agrees that shmir apkosa is enough. You don't need Shemira Mo'ola. So Shemamina, that shows that yes, our Mishnah can be like Reb Meir. It doesn't dafka have to be like Reb Yehuda. We're fakir. If it was like Reb Yehuda, then why is it mentioning so? In accordance with Reb Yehuda, it could have just as well mentioned Shur, and Reb Yehuda would hold the same thing, right? But Shur also moored that Shemira Pose is enough.
Now
we said that fakir. We started Ramani Bapakish had started by saying that our Mishnah must be like Reb Yehuda, because according to the mayor, you should be chayev with Shemira Pusa. Now the Gemara is saying the other way around. Now Rabbi is pointing out the other way around. If that were the case, the Mishnah would have said, Akon is sure that it. Now that it says Tsoin, and Tsoin by definition is something where Keren is not usually applicable, only Shein V'regel, and the Mishnah is saying Shemira Pusa is enough, that would fit better with Reb Meir's opinion that when it comes to Shur, when it comes to Keren, then you need Shemira Ma'ula, but when it comes to Shein V'regel, Reb Meir agrees with what we just said, that you need, that there are four things, Bur, A, Shein, and Regel, where you need only Shemira Pusa, and therefore that's enough, and therefore the Mishnah is using Tsoin to indicate that one. Yeah.